Today at Reader's Corner, Gary Crist, author of City of Scoundrels, The 12 Days of Disaster That Gave Birth to Modern Chicago.
You had this convergence of people on Chicago just when the economy was slowing. It created a situation in which there was tremendous competition for jobs and social services, and particularly for housing. Everybody was calling on both the mayor and the governor to send in the militia at a certain point. So basically you had these two political rivals staring at each other over a table while the city was burning around them. So it was kind of a stalemate, politically based. One of the worst race riots in American history. And of course, 2 days into it, there was a massive transit strike. So it was total chaos there in July of 1919.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Over the course of just 12 days in 1919, the city of Chicago endured tragedy, violence, and chaos that would test the resolve of this young, growing city still trying to determine its future. Today's guest, Gary Crist, believes those 12 days were the most impactful in Chicago's history, and he writes about them in his book, City of Scoundrels, The 12 Days of Disaster That Gave Birth to Modern Chicago. In early 1919, Chicago's diverse citizenry was on the brink of modernizing their city. They planned to develop lavish parks, build skyscrapers, and invest in roadways, bridges, and waterfronts. But on July 21st of that year, a succession of catastrophes, from the crash of a blimp in the financial district to a brutal child murder, wreaked havoc on the city. A New York Times bestseller, City of Scoundrels, is Mr. Crist's second narrative nonfiction work. He also is the author of 3 novels and 2 short story collections, and he was recently designated a historian to watch in 2012 by Smithsonian.com for City of Scoundrels. Mr. Crist was a guest on Reader's Corner in 2009 to talk about his book, The White Cascade, The Great Northern Railway Disaster and America's Deadliest Avalanche. He joins us today by phone. Gary Crist, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Oh, I'm very happy to be here again.
Well, it's quite a journey from the Cascade Mountains of Washington to the city of Chicago in 1919. How'd you get there? And I guess by that I mean, how did you manage to put these 4 events together? They're not exactly related in kind. They're related in timing. But I've never heard of these things being thrown together before. How'd you stumble across this?
Well, you know, I've always been interested in this particular period, the Progressive Era. And the avalanche I wrote about last time took place in 1910. This is 1919. I think it's a very interesting time in American history because we were making this big transition from sort of a mostly rural, mostly Anglo-Saxon, mostly Protestant society to a mostly urban, multi-ethnic, secular society. So there were a lot of growing pains involved there. And I think you see it in technology, which is what I was dealing with in the White Cascade. You know, we could run these trains over mountains, but we couldn't quite do it safely. There was kind of a disconnect there. And in our cities, we had this massive influx of people from every corner of the globe. And the real question was, could these people in a democracy build a city that was formerly, you know, a frontier town? Chicago in 1833 was nothing, a few houses. Could they turn it into one of the economic powerhouses of the globe, despite all their ethnic hatreds and racial hatreds and cultural differences? And so it was a great experiment, the American city, and Chicago in particular at this time. And there were times, as in this period that I write about, where it almost seemed as if the whole experiment would come crashing down under the weight of, you know, too many groups of people wanting too many different things. So I knew I wanted to write about a big city, a city of immigrants, and there's really no greater city of immigrants than Chicago. I mean, New York has probably similar numbers at this era. But what interested me about Chicago was that it was such a new city. You know, it had just grown from nothing to this gargantuan megalopolis in just a few decades. So there was a kind of provisional quality to Chicago that kind of attracted me.
Well, it's interesting, as I was reading the book, the thought did occur to me from my earlier readings a long time ago of Lincoln Steffens, the muckraker that was operating around the turn of the century. And he would write about municipal corruption in so many of these cities. And in a way, taking the blimp crash out, you could probably go through the first couple of decades of the 20th century and identify a dozen different American cities that were, as you said earlier, experiencing this massive influx of people and trying to figure out how to deal with it.
Yeah, it definitely was a time of adolescence for American cities. And, you know, they were growing so fast and government kind of couldn't keep pace. So they developed all of these kind of shortcuts and ways of getting votes of recent immigrants who perhaps, you know, didn't have this tradition of democracy from the countries they came from. So a vote was not that important to them. So I think it was an adolescent time for these cities. And as we all know, adolescents are notoriously hard to predict and hard to control. And that's another thing that kind of appeals to me about this particular time in history.
And again, you're dealing with a race riot, a blimp crash, a transit strike, a brutal child murder. You mentioned the massive influx of people. Let's talk for a moment. Not too long ago, a best-selling book came out, The Warmth of Other Suns, which is the story of the Great Migration northward. And tell us what was happening in Chicago at this time. And then there was one or two very important people who were active in civil rights in Chicago at that time that play a role in your book.
Right. The Warmth of Other Suns mostly focuses on the later phases of the Great Migration. In 1919, this was really the very beginning of the Great Migration of African Americans from the South. What happened was the war was on in Europe, so industry in places like Chicago was really gearing up to wartime production, but they had a real shortage of labor because so many soldiers were off in Europe fighting the war. So there was real recruitment efforts. You know, they had factories would send people down south to try to get people to move north. And of course, it was a receptive message down there because Jim Crow was really just gaining ground then, and the boll weevil was making cotton production very difficult. So people were ready to move north, and they did in great, great numbers, particularly to Chicago. I don't have the numbers before me, but the black population of Chicago in the space of 3 years just explosively grew. And this was all kind of fine as long as wartime production was up and factories were humming. But of course, when the war was over, the factories had to sort of wind back down from their wartime peak production. At the same time, all those soldiers were coming back looking for their old jobs. So you had this convergence of people on Chicago just when the economy was slowing. And so it created a situation in which there was tremendous competition for jobs and social services, and particularly for housing. And that was the cause of a lot of the trouble, because people were moving in, African Americans were moving into neighborhoods that had previously been all white, and sometimes the white residents would respond. There was a lot of bombings of apartment buildings where African Americans had moved in. So this was creating a very tense atmosphere over the course of 1919, and it really was just waiting for something that would sort of start the conflagration going. And you know, it was hot weather. The blimp crash, I think, put everybody on edge. You know, this high-profile child murder. I think at the time, people were just a little bit in shock that all of this was happening at once. And there was this sense that the city is changing. So there was this trauma that had been building up over the course of 1919 and just gained acceleration in July. And then there was this incident at a Southside beach that just spiraled into what is one of the worst race riots in American history. And, of course, in 2 days into it, there was a massive transit strike, which shut down all L trains and streetcars. And so people had to get to work on the streets just at the height of the violence. So it was total chaos there in July of 1919.
Well, how would you compare it to earlier crises, the Great Fire of 1871? I mean, that certainly the riots that came later in 1968, but they were, I guess, to some extent, even though the fire was a horrible event, they were singular events. And what I guess we have here is just these unrelated events all coming together in 12 days.
You know, some people say that the fire was in some way one of the best things that could have happened to Chicago. Chicago had grown before the 1871 fire, had grown so rapidly. All the buildings were wood, or most of the buildings were wood. And the fire came, and it was tragic, and lots of people lost their lives and property. But the rebuilding was very quick, and it created kind of an economic boom eventually. So sometimes the physical disasters are easier to recover from because, as we're seeing, with a recent hurricane here in the East, suddenly builders are building and the economy kind of hums to make up for a physical tragedy. But something like a race riot, that can really leave lasting scars. And I think this one did in Chicago. I mean, it set the tone for race relations in the city for many decades to come. And I think really kind of hardened the color line that had been developing on a de facto basis over the previous few years during the Great Migration. And I think it left kind of a legacy of racial segregation in the city that persists to this day. Chicago remains one of the most segregated cities in the country. So sometimes these physical disasters are easier to recover from than these psychological disasters.
Well, one of the things that was so obvious about your book is that there's one incredibly large and looming personality that oversees so much of this book and all the events, and that's this mayor, Big Bill Thompson. And I must say, as somebody who lived in Chicago for many years, you'd hear his name every now and then, but in modern day Chicago, you probably have to go to the Chicago Historical Society to learn anything about Big Bill Thompson. But help us understand who this guy was. He probably wasn't unlike other powerful political bosses of that era. As I mentioned earlier, I'm in the middle of watching Boardwalk Empire, the story of Enoch Thompson of Atlantic City. And as I'm reading your book, I'm thinking, I mean, these guys aren't exactly the same, that's for sure. But there are some parallels there.
Oh, definitely. I have to say that Big Bill Thompson was really God's gift to any narrative historian.
That's
so
right.
He's this extremely colorful, extravagantly corrupt machine politician who always wore this big cowboy hat and really bigger than life. He liked to think of himself as the people's David. He was defending the common Chicagoan against the Goliaths of wealth and privilege. And of course, he was also a big champion of these big building projects, the Chicago Plan projects, which, as you said in the beginning, Chicago had these big plans for just totally modernizing the place. And, of course, that allowed for lots of kickbacks and lots of patronage. So a Big Bill liked those aspects of it. So he styled himself as Big Bill the Builder. And he was just, an amazingly interesting character to me. He's been maligned in history from top to bottom because he was kind of a buffoon. That was his persona. But I think there was a lot of craftiness to his buffoonery. And he really was, I think, a lot shrewder than some historians give him credit for. And, he did a lot of good things in addition to all the corruption. He was notoriously corrupt, and he was in office when Chicago descended into the legendary lawless city of Al Capone and all of that, and he was facilitating that to a certain extent. But, there are some good things he did. He was really the first major urban politician who, I think, brought African Americans into the political process. I mean, it was a little bit of a selfish move on his part because he recognized we have all of these newcomers to the city and they all vote. So if I can portray myself as the friend of the African American community, that's a big voting block that will be in my favor. And certainly, blacks were responsible for his getting reelected a number of times. But he also did things. He actually did things for the black community that, so-called progressive reformers would talk about but not really do anything about. So he doubled the number of African-American police on the force. He appointed a lot of African-Americans to high positions in his administration. As a matter of fact, the newspapers once called City Hall Uncle Tom's Cabin because he was recruiting so many black politicians into his administration. So, he is often depicted as a corrupt buffoon, and he was to a certain extent, but he did some good things.
Well, the last two governors of the state of Illinois are in the federal penitentiary, which my friends never let me forget, coming from Illinois as I do and having been in the public service. But the fact is, this Big Bill Thompson had a rival, and the rival, Frank Loudon, was apparently a fairly legitimate reformer, was he not?
He, in the first part of his career, he sort of struck a deal with the Thompson political machine to help him get elected governor. But once he was elected, he decided, I'm through with the machine politics game. I don't want to do that anymore. And of course, Mayor Thompson said, wait a minute, what happens now is you're supposed to pay us back, by giving us patronage and all this stuff. And Loudoun wasn't playing that game, so they became staunch enemies. And that really had an impact on this 12-day period because everybody was calling on both the mayor and the governor to send in the militia at a certain point when the chaos got total in the city. And they're saying, send in the militia, send in the militia. And Mayor Thompson didn't want to do that because he didn't want to be seen as crawling to his arch enemy to call in the militia, because he would have to go to the governor and specifically request it. Meanwhile, Loudoun was going to run for president in 1920. So he was worried about making some sort of unilateral decision that could prove controversial, because in some past riots, sending in the militia had actually made things worse. So he was saying, I can't do anything unless the mayor sends me a written request. So basically you had these two political rivals staring at each other over a table while the city was burning around them. So it was really a kind of a stalemate, politically based.
I should probably remind our listeners, you're listening to Gary Crist, and he is the author of City of Scoundrels, The 12 Days of Disaster That Gave Birth to Modern Chicago. Well, I'm fascinated when I read books like yours, how all of a sudden you stumble across a character. It's like, how did he get here? And Carl Sandburg, to me, is a Lincoln biographer and, most importantly, one of America's finest poets. And here he is in the middle of this mess. What is he, a reporter for the Chicago Daily News or something?
He's a reporter for the Chicago Daily News. Yeah, he's already published the Chicago poems, and they were, they got good reviews and things, but he still had to have a job to keep food on the table. So he was reporting for the Chicago Daily News, and in fact, just before the riot, he was doing a series on the so-called Black Belt, which was the black neighborhood on the South Side, and he was down there interviewing people and writing these articles that more or less said, this is an explosive situation down here. So he was kind of prophetic in that respect. One of the things that really attracted me to this topic was, here we have this amazing situation, but there are also famous people who are involved in it, and people you wouldn't necessarily expect, and Carl Sandburg was one of them.
Well, the other thing that I found fascinating reading the book is that you have a great beginning to this book. I mean, anybody who picks up this book is not going to be able to put it down, at least as long as you're dealing with this blimp disaster, because you're setting us up for what's going to happen. But I must say, it reminded me of The Devil in White City by Eric Larson, which was a bestseller about the fair and about this murderer. And as I remember it, the blimp... And you might want to tell us a little bit about the technology and the role that Goodyear played, but the blimp took off from the site of the World's Fair, or close to it anyway, down on the south side of Chicago?
Right, yeah. It was an aerodrome at that point, they were testing. Blimps had been used with some success in World War I, and now they were experimenting with them for commercial use. And there were all these plans to have blimp routes from New York to Chicago and from Chicago to London and things like that. And as a matter of fact, the day of the blimp crash, there was a big article in the Chicago Daily News about some guy saying that Chicago was going to be the blimpopolis of the world. It was going to be the ground zero for blimp flights. So Goodyear had been building this blimp on the site of the old World's Fair, and they were going to take it on some test flights. And so they took it on one. They took it up to Grant Park, up near the Loop, where there was another aerodrome. And they took it on another one up the north side, and everything seemed to be working fine. And then the last flight of the day, which started at about 5 o'clock, they had a newspaper photographer on board. And he said, it would be great to have aerial shots of the Loop. And so they flew over the Loop, and they still don't know exactly what caused the problem, but the blimp caught fire while it was over the Loop. And, all the gas escaped or burned up, and the thing just plummeted to the ground right across from the Board of Trade building. It was right in the middle of the Loop. Went through the skylight of a bank building.
How many people were killed in that by the time it was
13,
all over?
And there were dozens injured. Yeah, it's considered the first major aviation disaster in American history, but for some reason, very few people know about it.
How many people died as a result of the race riots?
38 dead, 500 and something wounded, and there were also some big fires that left over 1,000 people homeless.
You mentioned the role that that jobs played in this, the competition for jobs. Tell us more about how that worked in 1919 Chicago.
Well, you know, as I said, all of these new workers had come up and all of the soldiers were coming back and the economy was winding down. So not just in Chicago, although Chicago was sort of the worst example, but the summer of 1919 was a record for things like strikes and lockouts and labor unrest because there weren't that many jobs around. They were trying to cut wages because the business wasn't so good anymore. And so this was unprecedented period of labor unrest. And as I say, this, you know, what we had in the middle of the riot was a major transit strike, which is just not what you want in the middle of a riot. So that was, you know, another tension that was going on. Inflation was a problem. The cost of living was going up, but they wanted to pull back wages because wages had been relatively high during the war. So there were all kinds of economic pressures on workers at this time. So it was a really volatile situation all around.
And somewhere in the close of your book, you talk about that moment when the Michigan Avenue Bridge was completed. And for anybody who's visited Chicago, the one memory you probably take away from the city is walking over that bridge and looking up and down the Chicago River and the skyscrapers that line it. Was that part of this plan you mentioned earlier, the Chicago plan ordinances?
Yeah, it was a way to bring the north side and the south sides of the city together, to sort of knit the city together. You have this broad avenue going straight up from the loop to into the north side. And really, that bridge made possible a lot of the development on what we now call the Magnificent Mile, which until this point was, you know, it had factories and things on it. But after this bridge was built, that whole avenue there, Michigan Avenue, that is really, I think, the showpiece of Chicago these days, was made possible by that. And a bridge may not seem that important in that respect, but since it kind of allowed for the development of the north side of Chicago, I think it was extremely important.
And you still have this character, Big Bill Thompson, presiding over this. So here's the guy that made all this happen. That certainly has a lot of interesting aspects to his career. It's not just about a guy who was a crook, but a guy who also did transform the city, didn't he?
Right, yeah. As a journalist of the day had a famous quote that Thompsonism may be corrupt, but it does build roads and bridges, even if they cost a lot more than they should. And it's true. I mean, they were riddled with corruption and, you know, lots of kickbacks and things like that. But they got done. So, you know, there is something in that. But, yeah, I had similarly ambivalent feelings about Big Bill. He really was corrupt and bad for the city in many ways. But there were these other aspects of him that I think are sometimes underplayed.
I think I asked you this toward the beginning of the program, but I just want to reiterate it. Bringing these four events together, was there any place you could go to find these four events mentioned on one page, or did you just piece this together as you realized, wow, this all happened in 12 days of 1919?
I initially came to this thinking that I was going to write about the race riot because I've been interested in racial issues and this particular period. And then this is a good reason why, reading newspaper microfilm is so important. I was reading about all of these other things which were actually making bigger headlines than the race riot at the time, this blimp crash. And actually the thing that made the biggest headlines through this 12-day period was actually the disappearance of that little girl and the murder of that little girl. That, it's for some reason, it really struck a chord, and that was almost more terrifying to people in the city than even having black and white citizens killing each other on the streets. So it was really reading the newspaper microfilm around the race riot that made me realize that all of this was happening at the same time. And, you know, I just realized that even if one of these things happened in a city today, it would be huge news. And here there were four or five things happening at once, and people were living through it. And I think there was really a point, particularly when the race riot was going on and suddenly the transit strike happened, I think people said, what is going on? Our city is collapsing. It's just dissolving into chaos. And, of course, they were looking for leadership, and they had this mayor and governor who were sort of rivals and were unwilling to do anything until things got so bad that somebody had to do something.
You mentioned the murder of the child. This was long before the Amber Alerts that we're used to. So the citizens of Chicago, I guess, were just freaked out over the fact that for a while this guy was on the loose. And then, I think you mentioned this in your book, it turns into, well, if there's one of them out there, are there others?
Right. There was an element of child molestation here. You know, they called child predators morons at the time, which is kind of an unfortunate term. But and there was this sense that this was going on, but you didn't think it happened in your neighborhood. Of course, it was happening in your neighborhood, but often cases wouldn't be reported because parents didn't want to put their kids through the horrible publicity. But this was such a sensational case, and it ended up, you know, with a murder and, you know, a girl being buried in the basement, that suddenly people were coming out and saying, you know, this man made improper advances to my daughter, and, you know, people were just coming forward with these stories, and that led to real panic among the population that this was a much bigger problem than they had anticipated. And there were, of course, all kinds of calls for, you know, anyone even suspected of this kind of activity should be sent to a farm somewhere and isolated from the population. And there was real panic in the city about it for a while.
You had World War One ending and veterans coming home, and we've already discussed the fact that these veterans are looking for jobs, and they're competing with folks coming up from the South. They're competing with others in the city. I'm just curious as to the role Big Bill Thompson plays in this. Strangely enough, and I've never heard of this in American politics, a politician getting on the wrong side of veterans. But it had to do something with a loyalty issue.
Yeah, he was often called Kaiser Bill because he was suspected of having German sympathies. What he was a pacifist in World War One, which at that time was unacceptable for people. I mean, you know how when a war starts, suddenly if you're not a patriot, you're the enemy. And that kind of happened to Big Bill. He thought that he had so many Germans in the Chicago population that he didn't want to be perceived as anti-German. He didn't want to be perceived as pro-war. So he was saying, oh, this war is a waste of American blood on foreign soils and things like that, and he was being pilloried for it. As a matter of fact, one preacher said that he should be hanged on the shores of Lake Michigan or something like that. So it was kind of a political calculation, I think, that he made, that if I'm against the war, that's going to play well with my German constituents, and also it's going to play well with my Irish constituents because, you know, the Irish and the English were having real problems at this point, and anything that was anti-British was applauded by the Irish population. So, you know, when you take the Irish and the Germans in 1919 Chicago, that is a substantial part of the electorate. So it was a political calculation on his part, and I don't think it quite worked because people really did react against it and call him pro-German, and all of the soldiers were against him. So that was an unforeseen difficulty for him in getting reelected in 1919, but he did manage to do it anyway.
Well, Gary, we sure appreciate your being with us today. Most importantly, thanks for the book. The book is City of Scoundrels, The 12 Days of Disaster That Gave Birth to Modern Chicago. Thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks for having me.
Next week, Mitchell Zukov, author of Lost in Shangri-La, a true story of survival adventure and the most incredible rescue mission of World War II. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.